Welcome to the latest episode with Cameron McCune and Bob Dobbs. This is November 17th, 2022. Now, we missed a week last week. Normally, we do it every 2 weeks. And this is the 60th episode. And we're on page 124, 125. We did two Croker quotes. Page 124, 125, but my blue commentary we didn't get to. So the quotes are at the end of the last session, number 59. You can go back if you want to hear them at about the 2 minute and 2 hour, 4 minute mark. And the whole thing is 2 hours and 21 minutes. So what do I say here? We talk about McLuhan, and he's not writing books. That's 123. Four Aristotelian causes. He doesn't want to write books. And then the intermedia action, which was his new theme and cliched archetype, talked about that. Then we come to the Croker quotes. So Croker says, this is 125, let me check. No, 124, halfway down. After Croker's quote, the will to technology and the culture of nihilism, I say, when, quote, we have broken beyond industrial, that's quoting Croker in 2004, then we're in this weird zone, as Baudrillard was saying, quote, we're neither active nor passive, but we're fully involved. And then complicit. Does Croker say complicit or Baudrillard? Yeah, Croker says complicit. Complicit in quotes. Complicit in the, quote, vectors of an emergent form of finance capital that through the medium of the digital nervous system and biogenetics is reprocessing the classical codes of the commodity form into the flesh trade. Then I say, we're becoming anthropomorphic physical, which is my term from my chart. Then Croker says, go back up, just check if it's, I think it's, yeah. He says, of surplus bodies and surplus imagination, and doing so in a traditional capitalist style that is global only in the sense of monopoly. End of quote. And I say, we're living a life of five bodies via this advanced technology, but we're anchoring our icon of this complexity in the afterimage of the bureaucratic chemical body. We're anchoring our icon of this complexity in the, you know, limiting it to the old chemical body. Then I say,
do you, the word anchoring is interesting there, but do you really mean by anchoring only limiting? Or do you mean something like emphasizing within the complex of the five?
Yeah, it's a fetish. It's a identity crisis. We're trying to get solid somewheres, land somewheres, yeah. And we're doing it in the image of the chemical body because you can't get back to pure chemical body. You've got the bodies overlaying that. So I say you're dealing with the after image of the bureaucratic chemical body. And it's bureaucratic because you can be bureaucratic in the chemical body. You know, you're dealing with other flesh. So Croker has this term surplus flesh. So I quote that. Does he say that in this quote? He uses it a lot in his writing. Surplus flesh. I don't see surplus flesh in these two quotes from Croker. I'll just go back up here. Actually, I'm looking at the first quote from Croker. That's what I'm talking about. And then the second quote. He doesn't have the phrase surplus flesh. So I'm quoting what I know he says a lot, surplus flesh. So I say, surplus flesh is what's sitting on the planet, an old nose cone. And I could have put that in quotes because McLuhan in Counterblast 69 calls the Earth an old nose cone, right?
And, yep.
And then I say people's bodies are obsolete, and I'm using the cliche meaning of obsolete, which is not perfect in the McLuhan thing. But you could say when something's obsolete, you get more of it. So we get more and more chemical bodies, and that's called overpopulation, right? And that's
yep.
McLuhan's obsolescence. People's bodies are obsolete, and surplus minds are obsolete, too. And then I quote him again, and the medium of the digital nervous system and biogenetics is reprocessing the classical codes of the commodity form into our bodies, of which there are too many anyway. One should be happy that we're mutating our bodies. We're using them to get a token fee. What the hell does that mean? We're using them to get a token fee. Then I quote Coker again, and doing so in a traditional capitalist style that is global only in the sense of monopoly, unquote. This economy is global because it's a monopoly, which is global. It's a small world for the mega capitalists. They can fly over anywhere. So then I seem to have three Coker quotes. Let me just check that. Do you see that? Is it three?
You have one on 124. You have one on 125.
Oh, okay. All right.
I don't see another one.
All right. So I mistook from the second quote. I thought it was new. Not in the second quote. But it is in the second quote. So I say they can fly. The mega capitalists can fly over the little village wherever they want very easily. So then I say capitalism is obsolete. And now we've got a new politics based on chaos theory. It adopts. Now, there's Trump. Hey, right? There's me on my way to explaining Trump and the tech body. It adopts quantum metaphors. And I quote, symbolism, virtuality, perturbations, morphological changes of state, a virtual optics that exists only because it is aware of unintended consequences of technology. It knows. It's got a popular McLuhan sensibility. There's been enough accidents, you know, from the 60s on that people say, yeah, there's a lot of unintended stuff going on here. They're not sophisticated like McLuhan, but they're intuiting that. And I kind of say, you know, over the last 10 years, people are natural media ecologists in the old sense or a limited sense, not in a sophisticated sense. But people were becoming, you know, that old quote from Tennyson, the child is father to the man. That becomes popular wisdom. McLuhan's a paranoid level of media ecology is becoming popular wisdom. You know what I mean?
Yep.
There is a desire to slow down things, or we shouldn't be rushing into this stuff. So that is Westerners becoming tribal again. You know, they would kill the inventors of machines. So we were retrieving the paranoid level of media ecology of primitive societies, right? They didn't like new technologies. So I don't know if I say that, but I have said that in other places, which is another way the limited understanding of McLuhan, which we don't do, that leads to knee-jerk media ecology. You know what I mean? Because
sure.
there's actually
That is what media ecology is.
Yeah. Well, yeah, media ecology as people use it. But there is a vision of an interacting and a balanced situation that people can't see, a balanced ecology or a interacting, comprehensive, holistic something that McLuhan actually, as a poet, was seeing there was an order in society, but nobody knew how.
Well, that's right. But order doesn't necessarily mean balanced.
Right.
Balance is one possible order, and what McLuhan saw was the dynamism of orders, plural.
Yeah, and I would say your interior landscape gets to that kind of order. It's in the interior landscape, not a visual balancing order. That's a Western bias. It's not trying to balance yourself in relation to some outer world. There's no outer world to balance off. You've got to get an internal balance, which would be your imaging of where you are. And so I say you've mm-hmm. got to image that. You've got five bodies. That's how you begin to image what you're up against.
I agree with that, but remember that I always insist that the interior landscape is not interior, meaning inside somebody's head or
right.
Anything like that. The interior landscape is the rigorous consideration of media.
Yep.
And media are inherently extensions. So the difference between the interior and the exterior landscape is that the exterior landscape tries to get rid of the bias of human observation.
Yes.
To get to the real facts.
Yeah.
The interior landscape includes the bias of human observation as what needs to be interrogated.
Yes, and noticed and questioned, looked at, and figure out how to, other ways to look at it, not the conventional ways. So, so that often means you come up with new terms, new words to get out of the cliche ruts of normal words like capitalism. You know, McLuhan criticized journalists in the 60s as he would say, putting together their daily newspaper copy using the handy labels of left and right, and so lazily with those categories they could make a story up real fast because they're under pressure to produce for every day. That syndrome is so rampant now that the laziness of categorization has become a huge disservice.
Sure. Well, people now realize that there's nothing but categorization. That's what lazy media ecology is all about, right? That you can't get outside of the categories, so you might as well use them. So there's a kind of global capitalism involved in the financing and publication of categories and nothing else but categories.
Right. So and Croker tries to, you know, bypass that somehow by coming in with new ideas and not getting stuck with the categories. He's always dismissing the categories. Okay, so so the average awareness is because it is aware of unintended consequences of technology, which is what Croker says. Does he say that? Yes, he's aware that it's normal awareness. You know, that letter to Playboy in 1970, acoustic space was normal awareness, but nobody was aware of Finnegan's Wake, multi-sensory awareness. That's what McLuhan says in Playboy.
Mm-hmm.
So, media ecology. So I have here, I'm outlining some of the discoveries of the global theater. Everybody was becoming a, quote, media ecologist by instinct. So I say what I just explained to you. That's what I was getting at. So, and I'm saying, I'm supplementing that Croker notices that. So, I jumped ahead, though, there. What was I doing? Yeah. The global managers know it's going to be hard to control their crude way of doing media ecology, and which rubs, quote, Croker says, and which rubs the dreams of digital reality against the chemical body of third world labor camps, environmental shutdowns, genetically engineered food, and the triumph of economic injustice, end quote. Those are all chemical body activities that are turning into prisons. It, quote, rubs the dreams of digital reality against the human disturbances of third world labor camps. The dreams of digital reality, that's the life of the digital body, the chip body, which people are very engaged in. I'm outlining some of the disservices of the global, some of the disservices of the global theater. Everybody was becoming a media ecologist by instinct. Then, the more.
By the way, notice the overlay between prisons and categories or media ecology in the gross sense.
Yeah.
Right? Everybody is aware that categories are prisons, but nobody thinks that you can go somehow get out of those prisons.
Yeah.
And so the whole world is involved in the business of getting used to our prisons.
Yeah, so you have the post-structuralists Julia Kristeva write books like The Prison of Language or Language at Desire. You know, they really make a fetish out of that point you just said, The Prison of Language.
Yeah, that was Jameson, by the way.
Right. No, I know that. I just found a very interesting speech that we played last week on him. I should tell you about it sometime. So then in the non-blue text, the more serious text, so to speak, I go, as the global city was being imagined in the 1960s, we actually were witnessing the creation of the Android meme, in brackets a phrase I coined in the mid-90s. Then I say, what was lately missed was McLuhan's more relevant phrase, global membrane, in December 64, Nation magazine. So then I quote his excellent article on Burroughs, all men are totally involved in the insides of all men. There is no privacy and no private parts. In a world in which we are all ingesting and digesting one another, there can be no obscenity or pornography or decency. See, no obscenity or pornography or decency. Such is the law of electric media, which stretch the nerves to form a global membrane of enclosure. Now, this thing about everybody's involved in the insides of all men, and there's no obscenity, no pornography or decency, and everybody's eating each other, that has entered the popular consciousness with this collapse of FTX and this Sam guy, his name, Bankman-Fried, or Fried, right? Post-banking.
Yeah.
But he's known as a polyamorist, okay? the top of his staff, the inner circle, were copulating communards. So it enters into the population, this millennial level, extreme tribalism with no identity. They fuck anything that moves, and it's part of their business world. So I'm thinking of this Burroughs talking about the ingesting and digesting of one another. That is now normal awareness, normal experience.
Right. But, McLuhan's not endorsing this.
No,
this should be read alongside his prospect essay from a few years before this, where he talks about the pain of being alive and having our nerves outside ourselves. So what he saw going on from sort of his Catholic standpoint was very painful, but it was real.
Yeah.
So he was definitely advocating research. What was going on and how it was going on. But that's very different from saying that it's good. And he made that point lots of times, that just because he was saying we need to investigate digital media or electronic media doesn't mean that he supports them. It simply means that it needs to be done.
Yeah, if he's talking about something, it doesn't mean he's for it.
Correct.
What he used to say. But this is a great statement. You have to read it carefully. We are all ingesting and digesting one another. There can be no obscenity or pornography, but there can be no good. There can be no decency. See? You have no posture available to pretend that your identity is preserving something or you're standing for something. See, that's really important. It's easy to say there can be no obscenity or pornography because the liberal attitude of the 60s and 70s was, what's it matter? It's just a chemical body. But the liberals think that position of tolerating chaos, so to speak, and not normal social rules, they think that's a decent, up-to-date posture. But that's not even valid. You can't be decent. That's really important.
Mm-hmm. What he's talking about there is people or the whole world being within the unconscious.
Yeah.
And within the dynamics of the unconscious, there is no such thing as some valid category. And there's certainly nothing like traditional decency.
Right, so that is, what was I going to say? That's the planet of the dead. And he talks about the Gutenberg Galaxy, about the archetypes of the private postures of mind that Alexander Pope dealt with, anticipating Freud. And then now we're dealing in the 20th century with the archetypes of the collective postures of media communication, and they are being absorbed. They are being disappeared in the intermedia action process, right? And then it looks like Finnegan's Wake. So the chemical body issue is gone, and the postures that people can make with their individual mind, their literate brain, is now dealing with the Armageddon, the apocalypse of the cliche, of the archetypes of collective postures, which are media. They're the archetypes of the social unconscious, he calls them, page 31 of Counterblast. Those are very profound statements. That's what you got to understand to get what McLuhan's talking about. And what you just said was a translation of what I'm saying.
All right. Yeah.
You know, that I'm quoting the McLuhan that you're not quoting, but you're saying what he said on page 31.
Yep.
You know, the archetypes of the private postures of mind, that private posture of mind comes in with literacy, but you have to understand that was already starting to be made conscious because the archetypes of visual space were coming in. The collectivities were starting, the mass media of the printing press, and this is what Pope wrote about in the Dunciad, right? Talking about the explosion of print, the blurring, the blinding. So, and these are, when you get these, they're beautiful images, and you see that it began with Pope and ends with Phineas Wake. And you see Joyce seems to be aware of that. So he goes through the Pope gang, which is Gulliver's Travels, Dean Swift, and Tristram Shandy, and another guy I can't remember. Stern does Tristram Shandy. He got Pope and Swift, and maybe some other guy, Arbuthnot or somebody. They all were beginning to be collective mediacologists, right? They were seeing a collectivity that was a new unconscious. And then you get this situation at the end where there is no unconscious other than that the collective consciousness that's happened electrically, people aren't aware of. So McLuhan would say that we market the unconscious. The old literate unconscious is the content of pornography or any issue that's considered radical or conservative, any posture. That is what's sold. And so you have the William Buckleys on the right, and you got the Noam Chomskys on the left, and they're all postures of individual mind, and they're not addressing the collective consciousness. See, really important. If you understand what I'm saying.
They're not addressing it because it's invisible.
That's right.
And it's invisible because it's environmental.
Right. And if you can notice it and say it, then you're not fooled by any of the movements and liberatory or retrievals of fascism or, you know, old neoconservative values, none of that, you're going to be fooled. So you don't subscribe to any newspaper or any magazine. See, it's a very privileged position I'm talking about here. When you get it, I'm confident that I got it, you know, back in the 80s, went on the radio about it. So I never was impressed with whatever the chemical bodies were coming up of. But you have to understand that wealth was generated by marketing the old literate unconscious in all its categories and positions.
Absolutely, absolutely. So that's movies or novels have to be edgy, right? And what does edgy mean? It means that they're bringing up stuff that's in the unconscious, and people sort of know about it vaguely, but then somebody names it a little bit.
Yes.
And this is the marketing process of collective waters.
Yeah, the edgy is point out what I just said in a crude way, that there's something collective that's threatening everybody's unconscious strategy in the plot to novels and sitcoms. And they're all up against a problem that is very easy to see if you take time off and read McLuhan enough to get it. then there's, you can't make a movie about what's happening. You can't, you have to fall back on the old literate unconscious and then make that vulnerable under stress, which creates the tension of the drama, you know, from Fellini up to Martin Scorsese and the modern metaphor of the mafia, this fucking thing that's there, that tribe that's come back and is threatening everybody. The actual reality of, to see what I'm talking about and what you're seeing and agreeing with cannot be presented in a TV, movie, theater, book, or anything. At best, maybe Finnegan's Wake. But who the heck is going to look at Finnegan's Wake? You got to be luckily turned on to it, and then you explore it, and then you find out what McLuhan says. So creativity is obsolete. This is a major point, McLuhan says, in Cliché Archetype. Creativity is a cliché because it's only dealing, at best, an edgy, inarticulate expression that is going to fail because you're making a movie about a bunch of people. I used to say, if you see a movie with humans in it or TV shows, it's obsolete. There ain't no humans today or chemical bodies. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do know what you're saying. And it's, what you're talking about is related to McLuhan's point that jokes are grievances.
Yes.
So the edgy stuff that gets brought up, which is marketed as a kind of looking in the bedroom, or looking into the hidden motives, things like this. These are really grievances of stuff that's coming to the surface, but can't be acknowledged as some kind of
knee-jerk response.
Yeah.
Some kind of knee-jerk response to the situation.
Right. But that's, but that needn't be knee-jerk.
Yes.
Right? It's a knee-jerk response that cries out for detailed observation and study, but instead of that, gets marketed.
Right. And it's in the cliches of rock culture, the cliches of any arts scene.
Absolutely. And cliches of everything.
Right. And everybody gets strung out because they're not aware of what is consciously really stressing them. They can't see it. So they try to assuage old, knowable, unconscious things, and that doesn't work, whatever therapy they come up with. And so they all end up in heroin addicts and the whole ridiculous. I mean, the whole population is on fentanyl or something, you know? That's what you hear about, the small towns. So and this is so obvious when you get McLuhan, right?
I think so.
Yeah, and Burroughs is doing a good job here, or McLuhan's translation of Burroughs. All men are totally involved in the insides of all men. There is no privacy and no private parts. You don't have a fucking dick anymore. In a world in which we are all ingesting and digesting one another, and you can see surrealistic art or even modern, postmodern art, they show bodies involved and forms psychedelically merging with each other. That's what's going on. But it's a rearview mirror image, but it's the closest to the wrong image. It's the best wrong image.
So notice, if somebody were to say this about physical atoms, if somebody were to say, you know, some of the oxygen that you were just breathing and then got exhaled, I then inhaled it, right? Or you touched this doorknob, and I got some of your skin molecules on my hand. Nobody would find that exceptional. But if you then say, well, but that's the same way with the mind, that we're all involved ingesting and digesting one another in the mind, then people don't get it.
Right. They have to take a drug, an LSD, to get a vision of it. And because they don't know that they can rethink it, I was reading this book about these therapists now, the people take the LSD, and then they have to talk the next day to assess what the hell happened. But I know if you added the McLuhan element, you could get them to see it's in the present. And then they wouldn't need to have that cataclysmic LSD experience, because it's only going to get them up to the edge of what McLuhan's talking about. So you need to have a larger situation, a bigger ground than the LSD experience to understand. And this, I think, is what Theo was getting at, that McLuhan was the new, quote, mystic. He was the new Illuminati. He was seeing, he was the new seer, and the marketed seers like Tim Leary or Zappa or anybody out there who seemed, Warhol, who seems to be edgy, they never got as far as McLuhan did on a how to have a poise in this situation. A new, all the religion meditating techniques don't work. Prayer doesn't work. It might work in some community or something and accidentally, but it doesn't deal with this collective clairvoyance that we all need to become aware of.
Yeah, so for me, the collective clairvoyance that you're talking about is the new science.
Yes, and that's why he liked to say, well, I'm trying to match my stuff to what science demands. No, man, he was telling a new science, and regular science was obsolete. But he couldn't really say that much. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He made the new kind of science. So this is the law of electric media, he says in the Burroughs article, which stretched the nerves to form a global membrane of enclosure. So what do I say about that? That's a pretty good quote. So I say, we're announcing we're living with Mick Jagger in a small room. There's no pornography, there's no decency. So that's pretty. And there was an actual movie called Performance about 1970 about Mick Jagger being a rock star, and then some psychopath comes into his life, and eventually they switch identities. Mick Jagger doesn't want to be a rock star anymore, and the psychopath doesn't mind being Mick Jagger. So it ends with Mick Jagger driving out of his home under the other guy's identity, something like that. And McLuhan wrote a review. He was used in ads. He made a statement about it. Have you ever seen that?
No, I don't think so. If you have stuff on that, I'd like to see it.
Yeah, and I basically can remember the quote. So it's an excerpt from what kind of things he would say in 1970. I think he might have, don't know if he mentioned garbage apocalypse, which was a popular term for him in 1970, but he says, this dramatic changing of identities. And he says, this is notice of cancellation of subscription to a world. So he's saying, when you give up subscribing to a magazine, that's a major crisis for you. And you're now going to have to find another magazine to read. So that was the opening statement. And then he says, so I remember that. Basically, it's notice of cancellation of subscription to a world. And then,
yeah, that's a great phrase.
Yeah. And then he says something following, this is normal, this is everyday activity or something, you know. So it's a great statement. I'll have to see what if I had to find it, and I had to get a guy to find it, and eventually got it. So let's see if my search mechanism, cancellation of a subscription to a world. A world, okay. Nothing comes up at that. So that's not working. I'm not. Let me put the word McLuhan beside it.
Are you looking in your stuff or on the internet?
No, my stuff, in my archive.
Uh-huh.
Okay, I'll have to find it.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned 1970.
Right.
I don't know if that date is secure, but if it is, you couldn't have that many things in 1970.
Right. And it may not have the exact correct words. So I'll go over to my McLuhan inventory and see if it just comes up within that. I just did a general search. So, subscription. No, it just doesn't seem to work.
But didn't you say it was in a Jagger?
No, Jagger is not mentioned in the quote. That was just
no,
me.
But is he mentioned in the title of the
no
review?
No. It's a blurb that McLuhan did to advertise the movie. The director wanted a statement from McLuhan, so I guess they got him to look at the movie, and he came up with this interesting statement, and then they put that in the ads. Even though
but
nobody
didn't you say that isn't the title of the movie Performance?
Yes.
Yeah. So try looking for that.
Yeah. It's funny what he says. It's not. Doesn't help anybody to appreciate the movie. Nobody knows what McLuhan's saying. Okay, so it's not really working. Performance. My comments on the script, McLuhan's notes from Nina Sutton. McLuhan's actor. And I remember it was in Rolling Stone magazine, the ads. Throwing a snowball. Well, for some reason, can't find it right now. So let's hold off on that. Get back to this.
Let's give me the quote that you remember once again, the subscription quote.
It's the movie is a notice of cancellation of subscription to a world. Notice of cancellation of subscription to a world. And it doesn't
nice.
Necessarily mean magazine subscription, but I took it that way at the time.
Uh-huh.
People's identities were their magazines that they had. I make the magazine as a key medium in the Dobbs quadrant on the tiny note chart.
Of course, that's exactly what happened to McLuhan in 1930, let's say, around then.
What happened to him?
That he had to put in a notice of cancellation of subscription to the world that he had known in Winnipeg.
Yeah, and if it's 1930, he's only 20 years old, 19.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Right, that's when he says there must be laws in advertising. You know, he has this idea that there's some laws
mm-hmm.
that he could figure
mm-hmm.
out. Okay, so go down here to where we were. One, okay, All Men, Nation Magazine, Inside, Men Are Inside. Then I quote after saying there's no pornography and there's no decency. So I'm just saying words for people to note what the quote says. So I'm repeating what's said in the quote, but people can't read this stuff. It's too deep. So you have to tell them what they should see, right? Note the words that there's no pornography and there's no decency. That's what I'm pointing out. So in Marsh McLuhan, a rare thing, it was when he was in Texas, I think. This Texas University magazine, the Review of Books and Religion, Volume 3, Number 9, mid-June 1974, interview with Marsh McLuhan. And, of course, he's dealing with the crisis of Catholicism, so he's going to talk about Gnosticism. So he says, the theology of discarnate man, I should think, is going to be extremely transcendental and Gnostic. It's not going to have much place for the human being as an incarnate spirit. Perhaps this may be behind the present swing toward abortion and the idea of euthanasia. Then in brackets, why should we have people around when they're of no use? So
yeah.
There's a Planet of the Dead, chemical bodies obsolesce, and they're doing drugs to have a transcendental experience to kind of maybe crystallize a percept that the world's a fallen place, and politics is run by, he used to say, fallen angels. That's the you don't become a knee-jerk Catholic to overcome that materialization of the prince of the air. You've got to do a different move of the mind, or a new kind of percept, or quote, mysticism, or vision, or a new kind of shamanism, to figure out how not to fall into the theology of the discarnate man. So
that's right.
This is an important quote. It's McLuhan's personal, private agenda that he would, why he would say to Barry Nevitt, why aren't you a Catholic yet, Barry? You know, he'd prompt his close friends if they weren't Catholics. That was his, you know, he didn't do that publicly too much. Maybe his books were symbolic of that, but you rarely got him saying this kind of thing, this quote. Most people thought when they read McLuhan and about Flux and that in the 60s, they thought he was talking about a kind of transcendence. They projected a Gnostic image on him.
Yeah.
So that's why you had to read McLuhan enough to find out this other stuff he was saying in obscure little articles that you would normally never see unless you got access to the archive. So I comment on that. We're on page 127. I go, Gnostic. That's the thinking that McLuhan was against as a Catholic. He was not interested in the mystical. Now, this is limited because he was interested in a new kind of mysticism, or he was accused of a new kind of mysticism. So he used to sign his letters, Medium Mystically Yours, right? Did you know that? He signed his letters in the later 60s, early 70s, Medium Mystically Yours.
Uh-huh. But I think he was doing that as a joke.
Yeah, it's a joke, but it's also, you see, it's a double-edged thing. You need to understand the mysticism that's going to be retrieved due to a knee-jerk response to what the media is doing, because it's giving you a mystical experience, a transcendence, a discarnate, but you're doing it unconsciously. So you can see why the gurus, the occult became marketable. Everybody was doing the occult, which was supposedly, before the 20th century, just for esoteric geniuses. You know what I mean?
Sure. Well, even the Catholic Church got into that business. Everybody was in that business.
Yeah. And they were all rearview mirror, and you could notice McLuhan was sitting on the edge, smirking at everybody, saying, you guys don't get it. You're all dupes of this process. He, in a way, to me, he was quite unagitated. It was hopeless. Like, he just occasionally, once every 5 years, say something like this. You know what I mean? He wasn't out there talking it every week and making sure everybody understood it. He kind of accepted it, or this frailty, and that's why he told Mary, his daughter, in his letters to her when he was concerned about her divorce, he was saying, look, there's going to be a nuclear war by next week. Watch out. These men are handling environments, and they don't know what they're fucking doing, and it's going to cause a real problem, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And they look like, you could say he's panicking, but I like to think that, no, he understood how precarious the thing was.
Correct.
And he was still quite relaxed, still going around having a good time, being funny, being ironic, making little movies. You know what I mean?
Sure. Well, you can say that this is the theology of carnate man.
Yes.
Right? As opposed to the discarnate.
Right.
So the theology of the carnate man is a theology of a person that knows they make mistakes, knows they smell, knows that they're going to die. But they're at peace with that because it's a theology.
Yes.
And that was McLuhan. So one of the things he was at peace with, but at the same time pained by and almost horrified by.
In his last interview, in the last interview we had, Nelson and I had, 79, he's talking about, I'm into suffering. You know, mm-hmm. I'm not trying to be happy. As a Catholic Christian, I got to suffer. And so he was admitting, and he says in War and Peace in the Globe Village that pain was the new exploratory leading edge. Remember,
right.
He talks about the exploring of pain.
Yeah.
Whereas most people were trying to get comfortable, find a nice little warm place. So there was another point. So the exploration of pain, that's his final comment in the last interview, pretty well. And that is a shock to people when they, if they ever saw that, said, this guy, he didn't even want to be happy. What's with this guy? You know what I mean?
Sure.
And so something about the cath. Oh, yeah. You got the book Who Is or Who Was Marshall McLuhan?
Yes.
Well, there's an interview with a Venezuelan professor, some woman, I think. And in it, he's explaining to her why the Catholic religion is the appropriate religion in a discarnate time. It's the only one that celebrates the carnate as an anti-environment to discarnate.
Right.
So that's important, that point. So let's see if I say that. He was not interested in the mystical. Gnostics say, quote, it's a fallen world and I've got to get out of here, unquote. The Catholics don't say it's a fallen world, but they sometimes have to use Gnostic techniques to enjoy their drug taking. More and more abortion, which McLuhan was against, was happening, and he was attributing it to the discarnate, no body, no moral situation. Then I go, this is the Android meme. Oh, now we're getting somewhere. This is the Android meme phase one, where the internet was bigger than people. In Android meme phase two, the internet shrunk. And people had all kinds of small gadgets that they were still attached to, but there was a tinniness that wasn't happening before. The media would shrink. The parachemical body reappeared, the AP, anthropomorphic physical, at the end of the analog supernovas.
And why do you call it the parachemical body instead of some other body, like the astral body or TV body or something?
Because the media was shrinking and becoming smaller than your chemical body from the eye's point of view, you thought the chemical body reappeared. But it is a embedded chemical body with the other bodies. You can't get back to a pure, standing alone chemical body. So it's actually a new kind of chemical body or a parachemical body. It's not a chemical body. But the image is to retrieve it, so you have a lot of people, you know, the exercise fad, and then there was the jackasses, the guys that would, you know, hurt their bodies as a sport. Remember that fad?
Yeah, well, it's still going on, I believe.
Yeah, so you have people, you know, kicking their body around to make it feel, make it come alive. That
sure.
Is a...
Oh, you have the self-cutters and the self-piercers. And
yeah, so...
Sure.
I think Eric lists a lot of that kind of phenomenon in his Formal Cause book, Median Formal Cause or something. He lists a big inventory, basically the fads of the last 50 years. But they're all trying to get back to the chemical body. And so the parachemical body means when you think you've retrieved it, you haven't. It's a para. It's not the chemical body. It's something beside the chemical body. It is it's a new polluted thing with the other bodies
right.
in it. At the end...
Let me just ask a question here. Usually you talk about five bodies, right? You sometimes go on to a sixth or even a seventh, but let's say that there's five primary bodies, which are like the five senses.
Yeah.
And for McLuhan... understanding how media work can be done in terms of the senses. So the five senses are always there, but they're in different combinations.
Well, they've merged with the technological extensions, which have gotten smaller and more invisible in the sensory light.
Is that how you think of the bodies, that there's always the five there, but they're in different arrangements? And so they can be called a parachemical body, but really it's a molecular body of the five.
Yes.
Yeah.
They are overlapping, embedding. Generally, the postmodern view said by the word prosthetics. That's what they, in academia, they talk about prosthetics. McLuhan would say extensions. Yep. They like to say prosthetics. And they're more and more inside people. They're made up. Coker does a lot of analysis of the prosthetics in people, the new organs technical organs that are in people. So they're all, you're overlaying, Croker has interesting images, maybe made by his wife, Mary Louise, showing, I think he talks about the eyes in a chemical body skull are actually laser beams. Some science fiction levels coming through the eyes of a person because they've got the chip body inside themselves, and that's what's emanating through the eyeball, the chemical eyeball, the physical mm-hmm. eyeball. So, so there's all kinds of imagery and art trying to show this merger of machine and man, to use the old cliches, but you have to change the images. It's not a crude metallic thing that's embedded in you. Remember the Terminator. You know, he wasn't made of metal. He was some kind of weird fluid melting substance, right? You know,
I didn't see the movie.
Okay. The Evergreens, they said to me once, they were channeled through Michael Blake Reed, that in the future, you know, a couple hundred years, we'll be 90% metal. But they didn't mean hard metal. They meant, you might say, minerals, liquid metal,
uh-huh.
artificial stuff in our chemical bodies,
mm-hmm.
Industrial stuff, electronic stuff. So that's the overlay that we are, and that is what's being agitated by the whole situation. So then I say, at the end of the analog supernovas, that means there are more movies than ever, more books, more TV shows, all the media before the digital. There's just, that's the wealth of the old literate unconscious that is having a supernova. And then when people start to get into the digital, you have a collapse of the analog and you got endless recession and depression. You know, the chemical body is not having, it's had its supernova. Now people are dangling ganglia, which would be multi-bodied ganglia, that are demanding stimulation, constant stimulation. It's beyond the vistas of Star Wars and the traveling out into the universe, right? That's all shrunk. It's gone away. I didn't say, and the digital was now so tiny, and people wouldn't believe it was a radio station or whatever they were listening to. But then they forgot about it, and they got interested in the subject. They kept listening. But if you have to look at any situation as a mixture of the – but you have to look at any situation as a mixture of the bodies. Arthur Croker uses this projection all through a book called Body Drift, a recent book of his. So I cite him as someone who's on to what I'm talking about, the body, mm-hmm. the multiple body drift. So – you have to perceive this layers of invisibleness that is occupying you. It's possessing you. So the age of the smartphone and everybody looking at their black mirror, that's another level of mediacology becoming a normal awareness. Everybody sees that everybody else is possessed, because they're absurdly staring at their screen and not engaging in natural social interaction or looking around at what the physical environment is showing you. Everybody looks like a hypnotized zombie now, right in front of you. You know, that's
right in front of each other.
Yeah. And, yeah, we're inside each other. And so it's almost like, you know, this interior landscape of the magic mirror is a way to get out of yourself, to get out of the interior landscape by hiding in the chip body. But mm-hmm. The blatant zombiness of it is sort of unspoken. Because, you know, you walk along here on the beach all the time, and everybody's looking at their phone, and they're not looking at the beautiful environment. Mm-hmm. So there's always people walking along seeing that the majority of people in this holiday situation are ridiculously looking at an object. They're like zombies. You know what I mean? So everybody, they're polite. They don't go around and knock the phone out of the guy's hand and say, hey, wake up. Now, I used to do this. I'd be walking along, and I see I preferred, you know, nice 20-year-olds, nice pretty girls laid out there. And I go, hey, I yell out, hey, and they sort of get out of their sun trance and look up and see where the voice came from. And when they saw me, I'd be pointing off to the side. So they would look. They would look to see what the hell I was pointing at, which was nothing. And then I would carry along. I would keep walking, ignoring their response, because they'd look back at me and look at what the hell was he warning us about. So I would cause this disruption every now and then. You see? I was doing my, gorilla action every now and then. Had to be careful because since I walked the beach route every day, I could have gotten noticed by the police and the cops and the guards, right? There's that fucking maniac who screams and disturbs the peace of everybody. So had to be very careful in how I did it so I could keep doing it. So then I asked Ian about what was the effect, and Ian said, well, a couple people died, Bob. They were so shocked or whatever the hell I did. They died. They had heart attacks. Not right then, but later. So I tempered myself even more so. But anyways, I was trying to just, you know, shock them out of their telephone trance. What do you think of that?
The phone functions a little bit, one of the functions of phone, not the entire function, but one of the functions of phones like this is what used to be done by gum, right? And people chewing gum,
yeah.
People smoking cigarettes used to be a way of saying, I'm concentrating on myself.
Yeah.
I don't care if anybody's looking at me because I'm so interesting to myself that I don't care about them. And now the phone says that.
Yeah, you're right. I was thinking about that recently, that the reason people don't smoke as much and all those old habits is because of the phone that replaced
right.
it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the general restlessness of the soul. The uneasiness that needs to hold on to something. Now they got a fucking little phone that has much kaleidoscopic imagery to distract them. It's quite
an anchor gadget.
What?
An anchor gadget.
Anchor, did you say?
Yeah.
And then what'd you say after anchor?
Gadget.
Yes, anchor gadget, right. Okay, so now we know what I meant by anchor. Anchoring. So I'm talking about the present, trying to describe the digital unconscious, and where are we at? Analog supernovas. So then in my series script, I say, this referred to McLuhan's intuiting of the coming digital technology and its ensuing effects or medium in quotes. Most students of McLuhan might see this as referring to his prediction of the Internet, which he presented as a global information service environment. What nobody noted was his comment on the coming disservices of the digital Copernican revolution. This was stated in late 1968. He says this in the second version of Explorations, The Revival, in the University of Toronto Varsity Graduate Magazine. He started doing Explorations in 66, 67, 68, up to 70, 72 or so. So he has a quote here. This is in November 68. When the movies were new, they used literature as content. When TV was new, it used movies as content. The laser beam will use human dreams and the audience of the intellect right off the court decks. And you read this when you first read it. What the hell is this? The laser beam will use human dreams and the audience of the intellect right off the court decks. They will be scrubbed, but good. That's a really great quote. You know, he never went, quote, poetic like that very often. Right? What is the audience of the intellect? To me, that's the raw citadel of consciousness. That's that's aware, and in Vedanta Buddhism or whatever Vedanta is, Hinduism, they talk about the eternal self in yourself, and it's not really linked to your body. It leaves your body when you die. So I used to think that the audience of the intellect is that that awareness of your awareness, and that awareness is eternal or is ineffable. You can't grab it, do something to it. But McLuhan was pointing out that that was obsolete, and that was scrubbed now.
Mm-hmm.
That's what
I think you can see that in movies.
Yeah,
movies have gradually lost their topics.
Yeah.
So it's impossible to have a Western. It's impossible to have a detective movie. It's impossible to have a serious movie about a family. Everything has become a kind of cliche plot where some stupid idea is trotted out for an hour and a half, and that's the movie.
With a lot of effects. With a lot of, you know.
Yeah, so human dreams and the audience of the intellect, they've been scrubbed. It's happened.
Right. And so every now and then there's a movie like Inception. There's, you know, some abstract thing that you can't figure out what the anchor in is it in it. You know, they'll show multi-level things. I don't know if you've seen Inception. Mm-hmm. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I've seen it.
Yeah. So the guy goes through like five layers of dream or something. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
And it doesn't get anchored. And that's why I see what you're pointing out, that they know the chemical body, the normal story, is not valid anymore, so they just overwhelm you with effects and ridiculous movies. I mean, they're boring because it's just endless shooting and blowing up stuff. But every now and then some artist tries to show something closing to the edgy, and they will not have a anchor, a topic.
Correct.
Because
so in decent movies, which are nearly entirely foreign movies, there's no ending anymore.
Right.
There's never an ending.
Just carry on. The torture never
because
stops.
That's the environment that we live in.
Yeah.
We live in an environment without endings.
And that's the last line in Cultures Are Business. There is no finish line.
Yeah.
So, okay, that's a good way to look at the how to understand the phrase, the audience of the intellect is scrubbed. The audience of the intellect, which is that could be our collective consciousness. Since the mind, you were saying, you know, everything's revolving around this nebulous thing, the mind. So a word for that is the intellect. And everybody's looking at that.
Well, notice he talks about human dreams, and then he says, in the audience of the intellect. So with human dreams, you're already in the collective unconscious. And the audience of the intellect is something within that collective unconscious.
It's not the content. The dreams are the content, and the intellect is the form. There's always this duality or hendiadys, one by means of two.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got to have dreams and the knower, the known and the knower is going on in here, but he's updating it.
And notice how they will be scrubbed, how that relates to what we were just talking about with the carnate theology.
Yeah.
Right. The idea that the human dreams and the audience of the intellect can be and will be scrubbed.
But good.
It's not something that most people want to acknowledge, and especially they don't want to submit themselves to it. They want to try to be the exception.
That's right. Their audience of the intellect is untouchable, so they want to make that their essence.
Correct.
So
correct.
He writes.
They're anchoring.
Yeah, they're anchoring. They're pseudo-anchoring. So he writes in the late 60s in a letter to Playboy about the lourdes, L-O-U-R-D-E-S, of the new scrubbing of identities at Esalen Institute, you know, in Big Sur, California, where people mm-hmm. would go and put themselves in hot tubs and do all these therapies, they would scrub their chemical body identity.
Yeah.
Right? And they
sure,
would,
they'd be taking LSD. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
And they would put themselves through the ritual of the stress of that disturbance of their sensory life. So they were scrubbing their identity, but that was not getting to the collective issue that people were in. So
yeah.
This
that
sense
was discarnate theology.
Right. And so,
right. And so to call that Lord is perfect.
Yeah, he says we're, you know, constantly soaking, sudsing our identity and scrubbing. So that is, again, much wealth is made marketing that old scrubbing in workshops, retreats, every kind of therapy going. Everybody.
Sure.
And then you have life coaches today where, they, you know, you have somebody who will scrub your identity for a day or for a few hours.
Yeah.
But good. So, so I think what I appreciate about Ion is that Ion is aware of that completely and kind of satirizes it. There's a lot of McLuhan awareness. The way we're talking about McLuhan tonight, there's a lot of that in Ion's, what Ion says. They express that at level awareness. Now, they might be getting it from my brain. Often they just pick your brain. But I'll let them claim they're doing it. So we got here that article, that quote, response to new media. Did you see that Playboy art letter about Lourdes, the Lourdes of Big Sur and scrubbing the tears, he said, you know, the tears of the hot tubs?
Yeah, I don't know that I have seen that.
Yeah.
I'll have to remind you to send me that with the Bucky Fuller stuff.
Yeah, now I sent you some Playboy letters, remember?
Yeah, I have some for sure.
And it might be one of them. Because I thought I sent you every one, so if you get a chance, check that. Uh-huh. I don't know if I have digital copies of them handy. I might. So I go, this is my comment on that quote. This is the hologram. This is the later Android meme's actual effect. But I also placed it back near the beginning of this essay to shock the chronology of the Global Village section. Just to shake up, you know, to get to your non-linearity. Right? I don't know I'd have to go back and look to find that. So then I say, audience of the intellect is a curious phrase. A clue to its meaning may be found in these quotations. And here you come to your favorite article, Prospect.
Yeah.
1962. He says, this is really a great quote. And it's very, this is before he's famous, you know? He's laying it out. Before anybody, he's in 1970 in 1962. He says, and I think it is this multiplicity of media that is now enabling man to free himself from media for the first time in history. He has been the victim, the servo mechanism of his technologies, his media from the beginning of time. But now, because of the sheer multiplicity of them, he is beginning to awaken because he can't live with them all. See, there's the collective consciousness. There's the extreme media ecology that's going on, being done to people. They actually cannot put themselves back into a chemical body culture anymore.
But notice there's different meanings there. When he says that because he can't live with them all, that has the sense of not being able to live with a nightmare. But it also has the sense of there is a limitation that is native to human being. So if people are going to awaken, they need to awaken to their inherently limited self.
Yeah. So he says, you know, in the 21st century, we won't be able to live with this buzzsaw of technology.
Correct.
We can't keep up with them. So the multiplicity of media... that's really important that you're living in all these different environments, which came linearly. You know, there was the movie era, then the radio era. The slowly unfolding the creation of these environments, but by the global theater, it's all happening at the same time. So you can't get back into the movie era or the book era when there was only books before there were electric media. You can't experience that condition anymore. So that's why I say everything is a meme of itself, a meme of when it was an actual environment, an after image. So this is one of his most important quotes. It's how we are becoming awake. This would be his meaning for Finnegan's Wake, what Joyce was saying, what was waking people up. Not that everybody was falling asleep. They were, but the hidden ground of the environment was a waking process, not the woke of the chemical body fetishists, but there's a waking going on. And the Evergreens defined the second coming as a time of perpetual change. This, we have an environmental second coming. If you think of the highest levels of awareness that Christ was supposed to have, and it becomes an environment, that's what McCone's pointing to. The multiplicity of media, you cannot fall back into a trance other than the very subtle trance of not understanding this point.
Right. I think that's important, what you just said.
Yeah.
Because when people become awake, they don't become awake in the sense of having some sort of Zen moment of all-knowing.
Yeah.
Being awake is inherently to be limited, to be a certain person in a certain place at a certain time, and to be a kind of selection of the possibilities that are before you.
Yeah.
Awake needs to be separated from the desire to be God or something.
Yeah, there's a new meaning for awake. And so you got to be aware of the different bodies and how they are each one an awakening. But there's a collective synergistic awakening that you have to become aware of, caused by the overlaying of all the different levels of realm of awakening that each previous environment was. So it's I think if I talk like this around people, they basically don't know what I'm talking about. You know what I'm talking about, but I think if they listen to our dialogue, since we're supporting what we're saying to each other, then that can be believed, and then people say, well, there is something being understood here. So they might be inclined to learn from what we're saying to get
that's the hope, yeah.
Yeah, that's the more subtle point here. So that's why people say we're the best dialogue on the Internet. There's no doubt that we are, what we're talking here, nobody else can say this stuff. Maybe if you get DeKirchhoff and Logan together, they might get somewheres, but I don't think they get as subtle as we're getting. And they don't have these quotes handy. They don't remember them, you know? They didn't study it enough to remember the quotes. This is a good collection. This book is a key to an advanced dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it might be good when we came to the AP a few pages ago, you said, now we're getting somewhere. And it might be good every once in a while for you to say or to describe how you see this part of the book relating to where you want to get to with Trump.
Right.
For example, I have the idea that when you got around to the AP in the book, it was in a section of your pamphlet that has to do with chaos. And I was thinking to myself that you might be thinking that in order to understand the phenomenon of Trump, you have to be able to see the chaos that's going on and the relationship between him and that chaos.
Yes, which we call a tech body. So it's appropriate you say that, because this quote is what I meant in my chart by the AP. I have the AP, anthropomorphic physical, is the ground of the chart. It's 1960 to 1990, the whole period of the unfolding of the andromeme as an unconscious environment. So the different quadrants or disciplines or angles, they are extensions of the AP. So in the end, people are grasping for the anthropomorphic. Well, what is the anthropomorphic? That there's something about being human that's at the core of the universe. We don't like to think that you know, rattlesnakes are the core of the universe or something, right? We want to project that there's a human, and that's partly the idea of God as a human or some kind of man or something or a woman. That is the anthropomorphic projection. So all
isn't
media...
There also an anthropomorphic introjection? I mean, it's not obvious that God and the idea of God as a certain kind of man, it's not obvious that we look at ourselves and we say, the universe must be like us, right? The other way of doing it is to look at the universe and try and understand what it means to be a human from that.
Yeah. So media as extension of man, to say that the book's an extension of I, that's anthropomorphic. We're saying the book is similar to us, comes from us.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but to say that, the point I just made again, McLuhan is not only saying that the book is like us, he's saying we're like the book.
Yeah.
That's what the Gutenberg galaxy is.
Right. So that would be this interplay, tactile interplay, of the anthropomorphic. And we may, you might have to, I may be advocating dropping the anthropomorphic situation. That's the final bias. Because when you have multimedia that don't let you fall into any particular culture anymore, the sheer multiplicity of them, he's beginning to awaken and question whether there is a human anthropomorphic level. That's the challenge here. Mm-hmm. And why many people would go nuts under this situation. You can't find the anthropomorphic. So you have a great yearning for the anthropomorphic in business, in tourism, in everything that's going on since the global theater came in. The anthropomorphic is the hidden ground. So that's what I'm going to try to point out as a quote.
Well, notice how that's what you just said is built into the medium as the message.
Yeah.
Because anytime you want to talk about the subject, anytime you want to talk about the anthropomorphic, that has some ground. And so what that means, some medium. So what that means is that the subject or the anthropomorphic is not only extended outwards, it's also extended inwards infinitely. You don't get to the subject or to the anthropomorphic except by throwing out some kind of anchor, but no anchor has legitimacy.
Right, that's where I understand Joyce and it made sure the wake had no ground, couldn't find what the anthropomorphic was. So yeah, what you were saying made me want to say there is no anthropomorphic today.
Right.
That's the problem, and everything is. Well, there's a yearning for old-fashioned anthropomorphism, you know, the chemical body, the nature, the romanticization of nature and ecology and the planet, the divine planet and all that stuff. That's part of this anthropomorphic knee-jerk response.
Yeah, anthropomorphic anchoring.
Yes, looking for an anchor. And I don't. Most people, they're not going to see it worthwhile to go that far. They just want to just tidy up the earth, make it friendly, and we don't need all this fucking violence and wars, stupid. Let's just get back to what we are. We're all human. Why can't we get along? We're all anthropomorphic. You know, that's what most people are living for, And then it's expressed in particular belief systems, concepts about what they find is sacred. So mm-hmm. it's
but
really
no way to translate that beneficent feeling about the earth and your fellow humans into the political reality.
Yeah.
So people are sort of celebrating their fine feeling, and at the same time, the amount of war going on, the amount of screwing the planet in every conceivable way is multiplying.
So yeah, and you know, politics has been reduced to that. They just come out and say, you know, let's get together, people. Let's bring America back together. You know, Trump does this.
Yeah.
It's a basic, hey, we're all human. You know, let's just you know, be accepting of each other or something. That's the last meme that you can come up with. You know, it's another way of saying the Beatles thing, all you need is love and all is love or something. That is what politics says, totally unconscious to the violence that they're part of. They think by sure. saying it, you've got a break. You've got a you've gotten out of the problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, we know when McLuhan treated advertising in the 1940s and then in Mechanism Takes Command, that's one of the things he was pointing out, that advertising is good news, and it works in a way that we don't understand. So you have the guy with the eye patch selling yeah. shirts in some way, and nobody knows how it works. All people know is that more shirts are getting sold, right? And so what media are telling us in their multiplicity is that we're involved in something that we don't understand. And in our lack of understanding, all we ask from the ads is that they tell us how happy we are, and then we'll go and buy what they say we should buy.
Right. But the anthropomorphic is paranoid, so you got to have bad news to make you feel like you're surviving something tragic. That you know, you've bypassed the inevitable death you're going to have. Mm-hmm. So remember, he talked about you need a lot of bad news to sell good news.
Right. But I think McLuhan didn't talk enough about the motivations of the socially maladroit. A lot of the news about war or about crazy sexuality or about all sorts of stuff is an attempt to rub people's faces in stuff they don't want to be rubbed in.
Yeah, that's the bad news. That's a new version of bad news.
Yeah.
In your face.
Yeah.
And so much of news is just these idiots talking disaster. You know, why would anybody even look at it? But they can't mm-hmm. stop themselves. And there is an unconscious fascination with it, but I don't know who's doing it anymore. Apparently, not many people are watching TV news anymore in America. They're doing TikToks or something, or not mm-hmm. watching anything. They just...
Yeah, I wouldn't... Yeah, I don't know anybody that watches the news.
Yeah.
It's
and I don't know anybody, but I'm not functioning too much in society, but I don't see images of people doing the old media, but they apparently are looking at stuff on their phones, and it might be TikToks and stuff. Apparently TikTok mm-hmm. is the big medium right now. So, you know, 22 seconds, you know, you just get this quick disaster message or something. It's so perverse the way we're living compared to the old anthropomorphic values we used to have.
Yeah, question. That's another way that people's faces are ground into stuff that they really don't know what's going on, and they don't know how to react.
Yeah.
They don't know how to think about it. And so that's how the world is.
And they get anxious and they go on some stupid medication.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or find an anchor, you know, in drugs or in religion or in whatever.
I think what we're describing is that part in Revelation where they're talking about the end of the world and all this Armageddon stuff, and they say men's hearts fail. I can see that. People's hearts are failing. They're just going to drop dead, you know?
Yeah, I like that. Well, but, I mean, heart is also something metaphorical.
Yeah.
And it's, their hearts are failing for sure. Just families are failing.
Yeah, did I hear you say, when I said that, you said, I like that. Did you say that?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah. Yeah, you know that quote. Yeah, and so the heart is, the heart of the matter is the heart. The heart is the anthropomorphic, that there is something that you are connected to with your species, with humans. That is being threatened by technology, you know, taking over, and there's not any human heart level left. And so I know the baby boomers went through a despondency over that. Then Generation X. Every generation over the last 50 or 60 years has lost heart because it's been the same problem since radio, say, and the post-human, and it's just gotten more intense each generation. But
sure. Part of that is guilt, right? Part of it is the guilt of letting go things that were very important to your parents and your grandparents.
Yeah.
And it's built into humans not to do that, but modern media are driving humans out of that.
Yeah.
So modern humans become attenuated through that process, and this attenuation is a way of being anxious.
Yeah, and I find it embarrassing. I find people are embarrassing me. They're so inadequate to talking about this issue, you know. They're just hiding it all the time. So people are not as articulate at funerals or whatever, at wakes, at weddings. It's all like people don't want to notice it too much. Get it over quickly. Because it contradicts everybody's values. What's going on, the wake, the funeral, the wedding doesn't solve it.
Doesn't right. Well, everybody's conscious of swimming in a sea of cliché.
Yeah. Dead clichés.
So, yeah. And it's very hard for humans to come to terms with that.
And so it's understandable why, you know, the rumor that the kids don't want to leave their bedrooms, they're killing themselves. You can see why, right?
Yeah, they're making a point.
Yeah. They So where do I go from there? Okay, we can't live with them all. October 1962. So that's the Bay of Pigs crisis. No, not the Bay of Pigs, the Cuban Missile Crisis, October 62. McLuhan is right. That's what you would read while waiting to see if Kennedy was going to blow up the world, right? You'd read this interview.
Yeah, well, I hadn't thought of that connection before, but certainly that if you think of McLuhan's point that our nerves are outside of us, the fact that there were was pending nuclear war would certainly be one more thing to irritate those exterior nerves.
Right. So if you were in 62, it's basically around the 22nd, in the 20s, this crisis is happening for about a week, right? So if you were watching the news and wondering what was going to happen, and you came across this statement we just read, you would be amazed at this statement. You'd be open to getting, well, this guy's talking about how bad things are. Yeah, this is fucking bad. You know what I mean? I could see that McLuhan would immediately become very significant to people, intellectuals, whoever would read this art magazine. This is big enough, this statement, to get at the mistake humans had gotten themselves into in October 62, right? They stumbled into this fucking problem. And
I wonder how many people in the history of the world have actually read this article.
Tell about
not
three.
Very many.
Three people.
Yeah, and not very many people have thought about it.
I would say it was Robertson Davies, Robert Fulford, and Kildare Dobbs. They're the three guys who read it. And maybe Don Thiel would have read it. He always kept up with McLuhan. You know what I mean? He always was watching what McLuhan was saying. I'll have to ask Don through IOD. Hey, Don, did you read this article during the missile crisis? See what he says. That's another thing. You know, I could talk to any of these people, right? I have access to them all.
What did you just say?
I have access to them all.
Oh, I see. Uh-huh. Well.
Well. You go, well. Well, Bob, that's a little extreme. So,
you have always been a person to listen to every possible thing that's out there. So,
yes.
I leave that to you.
You what? You leave that to me, did you say?
Yeah, I'm happy that you do it.
Okay, somebody's got to do it. So, but that's really funny. This who read this statement? Not many people. For no way. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
they wouldn't
for sure.
Even.
I mean, the art magazine had a subscription of in the hundreds, probably.
Yeah.
Right, and then out of those people. How many that actually had the mag read the article? Well,
and
in the tens, maybe.
Right, and they'd be only people in the art industry. The puny Canadian. This is before real Canadian art takes off.
Yeah,
there's nobody reading this. So when I first read this back in the 60s, I go, "Wow." Yeah, I'd be there in the library or someplace reading this and say, "Jesus Christ!" I'd like what I want. Everybody. Please, I'm in the fort book, you know, in the library, Robert. Okay, everybody, shut up. Listen, you've got to hear this. That's how I felt. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was one of the most amazing bunch of words, that this quote. Because he was meta. He was going meta on the situation. Like, everybody's thinking everybody's getting numbed. And he said, no, nobody's getting numbed anymore. It's gone beyond numbness. Which is pretty interesting, right?
Yep.
They've gone to a nowhere zone. They're
yeah,
not
without
being,
notice, without noticing it.
Right. But this guy noticed it. You know, Eric or somebody said that Marshall would run out of his bedroom or his office at home. You know, maybe like 8 at night or something. Kids are watching TV and he runs out. Wow, wait till they read this one. And he probably just written something like this. But he knew he was good, you know. He was saying something that hadn't been done before. So I go, this is the beginning of the autonomy, the voluntary ESP. We're being disconnected from the electric ESP. Now, this is really important. This is another version of the heart of how we're going beyond the anthropomorphic. We're being disconnected from the electric ESP. We're being kicked out. There's just too much. So in a way, Marshall McLuhan is recognizing this isn't for him. The news is not serving an informing or warning function anymore. So in a way, Marshall McLuhan has recognized this isn't for him. Yeah, that there's nothing to be told. You can't be fucking told anymore. You're beyond that. You've been kicked out. It's interesting how I'm trying to say this stuff. We're being kicked out. The news is not serving an informing or warning function anymore. So I'm enjoying getting this because this is the important stuff I'm getting to. And you had to do that whole introduction, 100 pages of background, but now I'm getting the quotes that deals with a problem that no one talks about in McLuhan land. You know? What he's really warning about. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate that you have words to respond to what I'm saying.
But don't you think that the voluntary ESP is a new form of control?
Yeah. the voluntary ESP, and we'll have to see how much more I explain it, but there's no I heard a guy say in 1970 on CBC that he was at a conference. He was a psychiatrist, and McLuhan was there. And he said, McLuhan said, the goal is not to communicate anymore. Something like that. No more communication. And the guy, as a therapeutic guy, psychiatrist, he said, I was shocked at this. What the hell is this guy saying? We're here to improve our communication, learn how to connect, you know, help people, massage them, give them comfort. And McLuhan said, nope, no more communication. Now, I don't know if he ever said that, but I'm glad somebody thought
he
said
it. Oh, that sounds very much like McLuhan.
Yeah, it sounds like him, but there's no actual statement like that. He's saying, we're not here to communicate. I mean, he's called a communication expert. He was.
Well, McLuhan does say that communication is a miracle when it happens, right? And he also says that it's useless to talk about communication resulting from a linear process.
Yeah, matching.
The linear process just ends up in non-communication.
Yeah, matching, the futility of matching. So
yeah, emerging, yeah.
Now, if you understood, if I'm understanding McLuhan pretty good, then I could match with him personally. I could say things that he might say, yeah, I agree, that's what I'm trying to say. Like, we're matching.
Yeah, but I would say it's a intuitive making.
Yeah, yeah.
Because merging and matching is an impossible goal. It's a Gutenberg galaxy goal. And it's not needed. When people talk, as we're talking now, they don't merge their points of view or their personalities. They make sense by making. And there's an inherent disconnect that's part of the connection.
Yeah, he used to say that making came from fatio, you know?
Yeah.
Matching and making had the same root word. There was a making in matching as well as in making.
Absolutely, yeah. So matching is impossible. When in the 1950s, when McLuhan was on his way to the Medium as the Message and to the Global Village, he did a lot of work with art theory.
With what? Art theory, did you say?
Art theory, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the thing that he was caught up with was the idea that art is never a merging. It's never a matching. It's always a way of sort of fooling the audience to look at something in a certain way. And so then that made McLuhan think, well, maybe that's what media are. Not media as newspapers, radios, or whatever, but as media as a mode of sensibility.
You mean a kind of making?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, which is obvious once you get that, the media makes new spaces. So
yeah.
Now,
but he got that from art theory, basically.
Yeah, so ESP is a matching, or thinking your gut. The other person, you know what they're thinking or something. You've matched with what you think you got. So as you get more disconnected, then the making mania takes over, and more people semi-consciously recognize. So the public becomes the silent majority. They don't talk. They're silent. And when they do or forced to match or make or pretend they're fellow citizens, be anthropomorphic, I call that voluntary ESP. You pretended you were matching, that you were agreeing. But more and more, it was hard for people to get into talking about what they're actually matching about because they found out they weren't. So he said by the late 60s, language was diminishing. People weren't talking as much. They were listening to people talk on machines. They were listening to music and all the electronic entertainment. But between the chemical bodies, there was less matching. So You had the fake matching. I think that's what I'm talking about when I say voluntary ESP. We're being disconnected from the electric ESP. That means we're into a total, the popular way to say it is that everybody's hallucinating. There's no matching. So the matching part of everybody being in the electric space, the global membrane, has a sight part of it, a matching. That was a minor thing. The disconnected and making aspect of the mixture of making and matching dominated over the matching. So we're being disconnected from the electric unity.
And how do you see that with the hologram?
The hologram is a framing of this crazy chaos. Like, the satellites go around the planet, and they, by 1968, they start making news stories from what they're getting on the satellites. So they're trying to present a coherent message for the day. Walter Cronkite had to say at the end, this is the way it is, right? So you're making an image. So the hologram was a frame. It's kind of visual space. But it was more than that because every little part was as big as the frame. There was no... Every point was part of the frame. Not the, there wasn't a center part, and then no mar. Then there was no margins. So it was. I would say it was a framing. Maybe the retrieval of visual space, an after image of visual space, because it was something you could imagine that you saw, and it would enclose the Earth. So,
yeah.
But it was. Plural. It was acoustic in the other senses, but it, in general, I guess the dominant effect was you're inside the proscenium arch. You're inside a theater, which is a visual thing. I don't know. What did you say? You said something else there.
I said that the hologram is essentially plural.
Did you say?
Because as you said, all of the parts are mirrors of the whole.
Yeah, did you say it's essentially plural? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
No, I get your plural point.
It presents a visual image, but in the mode of plurality.
Yes.
So it's a complicated picture.
It's a fractal. It's all those modern geometries or modern images that designers came up with. They're trying to show this. And it's hard to, you don't have perspective. You have a bunch of swirls, Baroque spirals, I call it in my chart, right?
Uh-huh.
Orphic,
yeah.
Baroque spirals, Orphic, the whole sphere. So it's all the senses and their extensions creating a coherent consciousness that, you know, how tactility integrates the senses so you think you have some kind of organized perception. And most people live as if they have, and it seems they have an organized sensory order in their perceptions. The hologram was the beginning of that collectively, a sense of something being ordered. And the word that made the market, the news, and people would sit down every night and watch the news and be told, oh, yeah, this is what's happening.
Yeah.
And it was a total put on, but people needed it, and it would give them perspective. You know, I guess you could say that sitting down watching TV was a purely Western thing. Other cultures, they didn't have TVs as many as Americans had, and they may not be watching it to get a sense of the day. I don't know what Africans had one TV, or if they even had that, they might have a radio, but what do they think they were perceiving?
Right. So this tells us how CNN became such a phenomenon.
Yeah.
Later, CNN gave people outside of, Western democracies or something, it gave them for the first time this idea that you can turn on the machine and it can tell you what's going on.
Yeah, it gave you a design of your outer world. This is what's going on around you. This is your environment. The discarnate mosaic of imagery.
Yeah, and we'll take you there.
Yeah. So, and that began in 68 with the satellite interaction. There's a book called 1968 about the impact of the ability of the satellites to communicate with each other around the world, and news agencies could pick up, I don't know how, can't remember what I saw then in 68, mm-hmm. what footage I saw, but this book, I saw a talk by the author in New York, and there was some kind of reality that was now available through satellite hookup. You could be somewhere, you know, the sender was sent.
Something like this happened in the 1950s. I can remember one of the Grey Cups between Edmonton and Montreal was on national CBC, and it was for the first time. And the way that was achieved in the pre-satellite era was that they put up relay stations across the country.
Mm.
And those relay stations would bring you what was happening in Toronto or wherever the Grey Cup was being played. It would bring you that live. But, of course, it took time for the relay to, get from Toronto to Vancouver, let's say. So you thought it was live, but actually you were seeing it 15 minutes or half an hour or something later. But this idea of being introduced to what was happening around the world happened in a sort of non-digital fashion, non-electric fashion, in the 50s, and then got realized by satellites in the 60s.
Yeah, that's interesting. And as you talk about it, a whole bunch of dull images of the 50s in Canada and the Grey Cup, it's all so puny and far away in a little village I don't have any access to anymore. You know, the whole mood you evoke there of the Grey Cup in Canada, how puny it all was. But we didn't know it was puny. We lived in it, you know? It was,
that's right.
We thought we were in some place. Think of how puny Canada is. You know, it's just this population strung along the border. Huge.
Yeah, it was about 20 million people in those days, and now there's 40.
Yeah. And it's still on the border. And, you know, there's huge wildernesses out there.
Yeah.
So, but it all seems musty and black and white when you talk that way, or bring mm-hmm. back the 50s.
It was black and white TV.
Yeah.
It wasn't color TV yet.
Yeah, it was all dingy, Diefenbaker, puny. And the counter to that was the image of New York City. I remember a lot of people would go to New York City in the 50s to get excitement. That was the.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah,
and go to Broadway shows.
Yeah,
that was culture.
A lot of people in Toronto did that in the 50s.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, not just in the 50s, for decades after.
Yeah, but no, it faded off once you had color TV, and then jet travel. Then you could just go all over the place. But that claustrophobic image of Canada, determined by the limited technology they had in the 50s. It was a big deal to go to New York City. And by the 70s, I'd go to New York City, and people say, "What are you going there? That's a horrible place." It really changed once the riots in the late 60s and then the problems with the blacks and everything. Mm-hmm. People used to think Carol and I were nuts going to New York City. The image had completely changed in 10 years.
Yeah.
But we knew where to go.
I went to school just outside of New York in the middle 60s, and New York then was a wonderful place.
Yeah.
You could go to any part of New York and be safe. The Greenwich Village was not only safe, but it was an interesting place. New York in the middle 60s was a great place.
Yes, we went there a lot, and but we knew in the 70s where to go to experience what was new and interesting, the underground culture. We were at CBGB's before anybody. I performed at CBGB's, and there's an album called Underground CBGB's. It was recorded the first week of June 1976, and Hilly Kristal, he ran the CBGB's, and so Debbie Harry and all the punk bands, some of them later became New Wave bands, they all performed that weekend. And Carol and I were there for Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And I found that album on YouTube somewhere, a few years ago. And so I took all the songs and put them into my slot. And so I would play it on the radio on Saturday, and I'd say, well, I'm in the audience jumping up and down. I'm in that audience in that little club. I'm being recorded, you know. But there was nobody, you know, up in Canada where we were living, knew this. They didn't know. We were very avant-garde. We knew where things were happening. And we used to go to the Nova Scotia Art College loft in New York City at First and First, you know, down in the bottom of the village, the East Village, and stay there, walk around in Broadway. It was a Broadway, I think Southern Broadway, you know, a lot of the bums were in that area, and find these little clubs. And so we found CBGB's, and then we went there, and then it becomes a world-defining scene within a couple of years. And in 1977, there was a picture in Time magazine about the new punk scene at CBGB's, and there was a picture of Jello Biafra. He was the singer for the Dead Kennedys.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. And he's leaping about on the stage at CBGB's. And on that stage, 2 years before that, on April 25th, 1975, there was an open mic. So I went up to present my poetry. So what was my poetry? I laid a dollar bill on the dirty music platform floor, the little stage, and I got down and I did push-ups. So into the dollar bill. You know what I mean? My face was going into the dollar bill that lay on there. And I always remember Hilly Kristal. He was the smart. He started laughing. He picked up on it. Yeah. And so what was I saying? The book is an extension of the eye. I said McLuhan stuff. That's what I said. You know what I mean? I was laying down the laws of media because I'd just been reading it and been in Toronto, and I got all this all in my head. So I made a poem of McLuhan's statements, and nobody knew I was doing McLuhan. So 2 years later, my vision was that I was taking poetry and bringing in kinetic space to it, movement, athletics, which then the punks are starting to show up then and a little later, and they're leaping about the stage, you know, athletically. Sure. That it was hyperkinetic, which was a release from the tactility of the global village, the global theater of the 60s. So you see McLuhan's laws of media years later. He says tactile space, when pushed extreme, flips into kinetic space. Right? So the kinetic spaces, I was miming, I was intuiting it, and I did this thing. And then years later, when Flipside magazine would publish interviews with me, Jerry Piocca, who worked for Zappa, he interviewed me in the jungles of Costa Rica. And then when he wrote the introduction for the interview, which was called Entertainment Sucks, he says, Bob started punk rock. I inaugurated it in April 75 by my actions. And the archetypal picture of Jello Biafra 2 years later, he's leaping about and manifesting what I was expressing on the same spot on the stage. Anyways, that's an example of us tuning. You could find interesting scenes in New York, even though it was more dangerous.
Yeah, yeah.
So, anyways, that was me doing media ecology.
There you go. Good for you, Bob.
So what were we expressing there, New York? Yeah, oh, yeah, the Grey Cup. Do they still have the Grey Cup?
Yeah, they just are going to have it. I think it's either this weekend or the next weekend.
Wow. So what, is it a big celebration? You know, lots of new media?
I think the CFL is not doing very well. I know that in the Western final between Vancouver and Winnipeg, which was last weekend, they had something like 23,000 people in a stadium that probably holds 35 or something.
Right.
So, you know, there's something wrong with the CFL for sure. I don't know exactly what it is, but people appreciate that it's not the NFL, and they're beginning to express their disappointment in being sort of a minor league.
Mm. Yeah, because I hadn't thought of the Grey Cup in years. I kind of pick up a glimpse, in living in American culture, of the Stanley Cup, but I actually had not heard that Grey Cup term in 50 fucking, well, let's say 30 years or something. You know, it never, I didn't remember it. So it all seemed so, you said the words, and I immediately went back to 1955. That was what my association with it was.
Yeah.
But
this year they played a regular CFL game in the Maritimes.
Really?
They're trying to get a team into either Halifax or maybe some place sort of on the Nova Scotia and New Brunswick border where people could come from St. John and Moncton and Halifax.
Right.
And try and get a decent crowd. But, a game between Toronto and Saskatchewan was played there this year.
Wow. And where was it played?
In Halifax.
What stadium would they have?
I'm not sure. It must be, maybe the Dalhousie has a stadium.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not sure.
Right.
Or maybe St. Mary's has a stadium.
Yeah.
I don't know. They didn't get that many people. I think it was maybe, 12 or 15,000 or something.
Right. It's also puny. I'm sitting here ready to take over the whole fucking Global Theater. I'll try to remember my roots, when the time comes.
Yeah. Well, there's lots of Canadian in you yet, Bob.
Yeah. Yep. So I got to end in 5 minutes, so let's see where we're at here. So we're going to figure out a voluntary ESP, and then we have a quote from Ben Stille. Now, this struck me. 1970, Rolling Stone magazine. McLuhan comes to San Francisco in the fall, and he gives a talk. And so Rolling Stone covers it. And this quote really was amazing. When writing was introduced in the 5th century B.C., it scrapped the old tribal traditions of Homer and Hesiod, but retrieved the private individual man, an ancient form dredged up from way, way back. Now, that quote, holy shit, there was private man before tribal, It got me out of the linear phases. What is this private man? Is it a caveman or, something that's not engaged in speech or something? I thought that was a major breakthrough reading that sentence. What?
You have brought that up quite a few times. And I don't understand it. I don't understand what the private individual man is. Weren't human beings always social? How could there be a human that wasn't social? I don't get that.
Because you go back, before they were social, they were wandering around, which probably never happened. But it's in the realm of could have happened. You've got Atlantis and all these mythologies of ancient
civilization. But the private individual man had to be born, of two other people before him, and the private individual man as a baby couldn't look after itself, needed at least a family.
Yeah, but it was like it was almost like an ape, and it was quickly on its own.
And
there was nothing to...
You think that's what he means here?
Yeah. He's not talking to an illiterate man.
No, of course not.
He's talking like the private citadel of consciousness, that phrase in Counterblast.
He's almost talking about a pre-oral. But then the question is, what would that be? What is a pre-oral man? Because other places he says that what defines... the human being is language.
Well, they're gods. So. Now, I've learned about this kind of thing from Ion. The caveman didn't know when he died. He didn't know he died. They had no social defining things. They just was in a blur. They're all stone on acid, naturally. They had nothing shaping them yet. Now, that's how I see it. It's a kind of gods. But he says it once, I don't know, maybe one other time he says it, But it's an incredible statement, and the world should have stopped. So wait a minute, what the fuck are you talking about, Marshall? You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, that's what I'm trying to do right now.
Yeah, try to stop him. Well, I'll ask him. I should ask him. That's a good question.
Okay. Well, that's a good place to stop, because that raises a big question to think about.
Yeah.
For example, it would be good if you find the other mention of this.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the meantime, you might even have it in the pamphlet here, because I remember us briefly talking about this before.
Yeah, we did. So what is it I got to do for you? I got to get, the Burroughs, the Fuller, Bucky Fuller.
Yeah, the book, Bucky Fuller letters and the 1968 Playboy letter.
Yeah, the...
I don't have it. I have a 70 and I have a 72. But I don't have a 68.
And what was it about Lourdes? I think it's more 69.
Yeah, about Lourdes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was about sitting in the
tub
getting scrubbed.
Yeah, it's interesting how McLuhan, he was a great poet, but very economical in what he used. His words, his vocabulary is limited. He's like writing poetry as a scientist almost. And keeping the language limited, talking technically, and he would wax eloquent only rarely. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But when McLuhan talked, he always talked in a kind of multiple elusive way. And it's strange. Not many people can do that.
Yeah.
And he sort of did it naturally.
Yeah, so he would do it in the seminars.
When you read McLuhan, even from very early on, in the early 1930s, he's got this knack, even then.
Yeah.
Where he sees something in terms of something else. So it's like Mailer saying that McLuhan always spoke in metaphors.
Yeah.
And that's right. Mailer saw something essential there.
Yeah. Okay, so that's a good point. So I'll make a note about that's what we're talking about. So the I remember he once said to me through the Evergreens, he says, what you and Nelson say about me, I wasn't that good. And so I get to talking to a McLuhan enthusiast, not too many, but as we talk, we're really making a big deal out of McLuhan, which he might have disagreed with, but I think we're justified in doing this.
Yeah, but the big deal that we're talking about is his way of prompting thought.
Yeah.
We're not saying that he thought of everything. We're not saying that he was some sort of universal genius that people need to respect or something. What we're saying is if you read McLuhan, you will find yourself stimulated into and not only interesting thought, but into thought that gives you insight into the world around you.
Yep. So, like poetry should.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, so on that, I got to do some stuff. So congratulations for getting through another great dialogue.
Okay, Bob. Take care.
Okay, Cameron. Bye.
Bye-bye.